too, am very grateful to the Bradley Foundation for all of the support I and AEI have received over the years for so many of the programs and projects that you've supported. These symposia, in particular, run first, as Yuval suggested, by the estimable Bill Shambra, and now by his worthy successor, Yuval, I think have been particularly important in focusing us on challenges for the future. Yuval has asked me to talk about demographic changes and how they might affect the political and the policy landscape going forward. So I'm going to start in perhaps the most obvious place, the 2010 census. From almost every angle, the 2010 census showed that our demographic transformation is proceeding even faster than expected. You are probably familiar with the main outlines of the story. The Hispanic and Asian populations both grew by more than 40% between 2000 and 2010. Latinos are 16% of the population, up from 9% in 1990. Almost a quarter of all children are Hispanic, and they are a majority of all children in California and Texas. Asians are around 5% of the population. The African American population at 13% is growing slowly. Looking more broadly at the minority population, the National Journal reported that the minority share of the population increased over the past decade in every state, reaching levels higher than demographers had predicted almost everywhere. The next America, according to the journal, is arriving ahead of schedule. In North Carolina, where the Democrats held their 2012 convention, the Hispanic population grew 111% between 2000 and 2010. It was a good move for Democrats to raise their profile in a key state, although Obama didn't win it in 2012. William Fry, the Brookings Institution demographer, reported that the 2010 census reveals an absolute decline in the number of white young people over the last decade, and a smaller decline among black young people under age 18. Hispanics and Asians accounted for all of the net growth in the under age 18 population. The racial reordering among the young, according to Fry, is one of the most important stories of the new census. Fry reminds us that Hispanics and Asians are crucial because they are juxtaposed against an aging white population. The changes in our racial and ethnic composition prompted the demographer Joel Kotkin to write that demography is the best friend the Democrats have. In 1976, 90% of the electorate was white. In 2012, 72% was. In 2012, 70% of Hispanics voted for President Obama. Although their political clout is growing significantly, Hispanics have what Bill Fry calls a translation problem. They're punching below their demographic weight at this point. Out of every 100 whites, 78% are eligible to vote, citizens and age eligible. For Hispanics, many of whom are too young to vote and not citizens, the numbers look quite different. 44 out of every 100 Hispanics are eligible to vote. To use the example of North Carolina again, where we will have a very competitive Senate contest this fall, just 113,000 Hispanics are registered to vote, making up 1.7% of the registered voters there. As I said, Hispanics are clearly punching below their demographic weight. What do we know about Hispanic attitudes? To some degree, they are more conservative than whites on social issues, especially in the first generation. One survey question I like very much asks whether it's better for children to live in their parents' home until they marry. Nearly 70% of Latinos agree with that statement, but far more, 81% of first-generation Latinos agree. Only 45% of third-generation Latinos do. Most Hispanics favor a robust role for government, perhaps influenced by Catholic social teaching or by attitudes about the role of the government in their native countries. As the Hispanic population grows, we will experience significant political and cultural changes, and perhaps even, given the week's news, changes in sports preferences. 45% of Hispanics are soccer fans compared to a quarter of the rest of the population. While I'm talking about Hispanics broadly, patterns of assimilation are, of course, very different. Hispanics in Florida have different backgrounds and experiences from Latinos of Mexican origins in California or Texas or Puerto Ricans in New York. Even given the differences, it is important to remember that nearly 6 out of 10 Hispanic births are to people already living here. These children are citizens. And just to give you an example of some of the most recent changes in the politics, in political views of Hispanics, the Wall Street Journal poll this morning reported that in January 2013, 67% of Hispanics approved of the job that Barack Obama was doing. Today, that's 44%. So there are an extraordinary number of opportunities here. In recent weeks, there have been a number of news stories about race and ethnicity reporting among Hispanics and questions the census will need to address as the agency approaches the 2020 census. After analyzing census forms for 168 million Americans, researchers at Pew learned that 10 million people checked different race or Hispanic origin questions in 2010 than had in 2000. Further complicating this picture is intermarriage, which is growing and will change the face of America. We do not know how much intermarriage changes attitudes. The 2010 census reported that interracial or interethnic married couple households grew from 7 to 10% of the population. Intermarriage will grow, blurring already fluid categories. Here's another feature of the next America. The 2010 census revealed some significant continuity and some surprises in terms of geography. It confirmed, of course, that our population continues its shift to the south and the west. The demographer Wendell Cox notes that in the first census after World War II in 1950, the east and the Midwest accounted for 58% of the nation's population, and the south made up 42%. Today, the ratios are nearly reversed, with 60% of the population living in the South and the West and only 40% in the East and Midwest. The 24 fastest growing states are all in the South and the West in the 2010 census. Mobility is at historically low levels today, but of the groups that are moving, Hispanics are moving more than others. Cox notes that California, the state that we once called a political bellwether, added more people than any other state in every decade since 1920, but not in the 2010 census. Texas added more people than California did. Texas added 4 representatives to its ranks after the 2010 census. California did not gain a seat for the first time since 1850. Today, Texas is the true bellwether in terms of promoting successful diversity. As Joel Kotkin observed, demography favors the Democrats, but geography still favors the Republicans. Kristen is going to talk about the millennials, so let me say a word about the other end of the age spectrum. Seniors were 13% of the population in the 2010 census. They'll be about 20% of the population by 2050. The new census data tell us that the number of centenarians has roughly doubled in the past 20 years, and experts are predicting that that number will double again. Older voters are more likely to turn out to vote than younger Americans. Older voters have become more Republican and conservative over the past decade, with the number of older voters labeling themselves as conservative up significantly in the past decade. Those 65 and older are the fastest growing age segment of the population. The media tends to see this as a bad news story. All these old people living so long contributing to high end-of-life healthcare costs. And that's true, of course, but we could also look at it as a good news story in that the advances we're making in health have increased longevity. Seniors' work habits, lifestyles will be very different from what they were 20 years ago, and those will continue to change. Let's turn to another change that has had and will continue to have consequences for our politics. America is in many ways a very religious country. We are one of the most, if not the most, religious people among the people of Western nations. But let me digress here for a quick minute. Many years ago in the 1930s, Gallup asked whether or not you would vote for a woman for president, and here is the exact language, if she were qualified in every other way. needless to say, they changed the wording of that question the next year. But since that time, Gallup has added many other groups to the list. They ask people whether they would vote for a qualified Catholic for president, a Mormon, a Baptist, someone who's gay, a Muslim, and other groups. In 1958, the first time Gallup asked about atheists, only 18% said that they would vote for a qualified atheist for president. In Gallup's latest asking from 2012, 54% said that they would. Of the 9 groups that Gallup inquired about, voting for an atheist was the least popular. The resistance underscores the religiosity of Americans. That said, the religious landscape is changing in important ways. We've seen significant growth in the number of pure seculars, what the pollsters popularly refer to as the nones, N-O-N-E-S. Data from the General Social Survey conducted by the National Opinion Research Center shows that the group has grown from about 7% in 1972 to about 20% today. Born again, or evangelical Christians, by contrast, have been a significant chunk of the population in Gallup polls taken over the past 20 years. About 4 in 10 describe themselves that way. Gallup has long had an interest in religion. In 2008, the organization started doing daily tracking, building huge samples, and allowing us to see more clearly what some changes like the rise of the unaffiliated might mean. Frank Newport, the president of Gallup, argues, using hundreds of thousands of interviews collected since 2008, that although the number of unaffiliated is rising, we do not see other changes in indicators of the importance of religion. He argues that the growth in the nuns comes from people who weren't very religious to begin. Today, people tell the pollsters that religion is losing its influence in American life, and when the follow-up question is asked, most people say that's a bad thing. Young people are more likely than any other age group to be unaffiliated, but that may change as they marry and start families. A famous survey done in the late 1980s by Yankelovich Partners asked baby boomers to think back to the time that they were 18 to 29, in other words, to think back to the 1960s. 64% said that they had become more conservative since the 1960s, and the reason most frequently given? Family responsibilities. More boomers in the Yankelovich survey said that they were Democrats than Republicans, but the movement was all in the Republican direction. The degree of religiosity tends to be a better predictor of political attitudes these days than denomination. A Catholic who goes to Mass every week has more in common with a Protestant or a Jew who attends services weekly than that Catholic does with people of any denomination who don't attend church at all. Still, we've seen significant changes in denominational strength. Unlike many of the countries of Western Europe with state churches, there's always been a more open marketplace for religion in America and a great deal of churning. Here's one of the fascinating stats. Catholics have been about a quarter of the U.S. population for a very long time. The Pew Religious Landscape Survey, however, reported that Catholicism has lost more people to other religions or to no religion at all than any other single religious group. These losses have been offset by people who have switched, but mostly by the significant number of Catholics who have immigrated in recent decades, particularly from Latin America. Hispanic immigrants are shoring up the Catholic Church's membership. But there is now even newer evidence that some Hispanics are moving away from the Catholic Church to more evangelical denominations. Related to the rise of the nuns is what I call the rise of non-judgmentalism. It's hard to find direct evidence in surveys to support my contention, but reading between the lines, I believe it's there. Here are some examples. While support for gay marriage has solidified in a majority, large majorities say it is unacceptable for them personally. Attitudes on abortion have hardly moved at all since the early 1970s, but abortion is not acceptable for most people. In the 1930s, the Roper Organization asked people about whether or not premarital sex was wicked. I've tried to persuade my pollster friends to ask that question again, though I've found no takers. But when the pollsters started asking about premarital sex on a yearly basis in the early 1970s, a majority by that time already said that it was not wrong. Today, that's about two-thirds. In the same new survey, 58% that said that having a child out of wedlock was morally acceptable, up from 45% in 2002. Republicans have not changed their views on this question over the past decade. 40% of them say it's acceptable. But Democrats have moved 20 percentage points to 72% saying it is morally acceptable. Gallup notes that Democrats have shifted in a more accepting direction on the 12 issues Gallup asks about, while Republicans have stayed put. Part of this is what we call a composition effect. The Democratic Party is younger, and youth attitudes on many of these questions are more liberal. In a column last year, the demographer Joel Kotkin asked whether or not the family was finished. People are marrying later, fertility rates have been declining, nearly half of all women in the next census will be unmarried. The proportion of childless women, those in the 40 to 44-year-old range, has doubled from 10% in 1980 to 20% today. The reasons are many and varied, but it's not clear to me exactly what turns these attitudes and statistics around. People still want to marry, and they say their families give them great satisfaction. In a new report this week on polarization of the electorate, Pew reports that over the past 20 years, the nation has moved slightly to the left. Issues such as acceptance of homosexuality and immigration once divided the Democrats, and they no longer do. That may be why we see the needle moving ever so slightly in the liberal direction on ideological identification. Ideological identification has been pretty stable over the past quarter century, with self-identified conservatives outnumbering liberals. Still, the percentage identifying themselves as liberals is inching up. Terms such as progressive don't have much traction, and the proportion of self-identified libertarians hasn't changed much in the last 20 years. When Gallup asked people to think about social issues, the movement has been in the liberal direction. When asked about economic issues, 42% in their latest poll said that they were conservative, a similar response to the one given in 1999, the first time Gallup asked that question. 21% said they were liberal on the issue, up from 16% in 1999. On both questions, about a third put themselves in the middle. Up to this point, I've been talking about the moving target of demographics, but I want to try to answer a question that you've all posed to us for this session. In what ways has Obama changed us? Here are a few indicators that I watch. There has been no change in the proportion of Americans describing themselves as patriots, but of course, people are less confident of their fellow countrymen on this score. In a recent Pew poll, far more people said that the term a patriotic person described them well than gave that answer about the terms an environmentalist, a supporter of gay rights, or a religious person. Although the question isn't asked very often, a large majority in the 70% range say that America is the best country in the world. Only a small proportion of around 10% say they'd like to leave. The military is still the most highly respected institution in American life, though Americans' reluctant internationalism is much more potent than it was a decade ago. We're still internationalists, but we're tired of shouldering the burdens and especially paying for them. Ever since Al Gore and Dan Quayle lamented the decline of the family dinner hour in the run-up to the 2000 campaign, I've been watching poll findings on this subject. NBC News and the Wall Street Journal recently updated a question that they asked about family dinner hours during that campaign. Perhaps surprisingly, almost the same proportion, around 60%, say that they have a family dinner at least 5 times a week. In that same 15-year time span, the proportion that read a newspaper in print at least 3 times a week declined from 79 to 47%. The proportion that said someone in their household has a tattoo rose from 21 to 40%. Although most of us don't want our sons or daughters to choose politics as a life's work, that's been true in Gallup polls since the 1950s, we still believe that our sons and daughters could grow up to be president. Finally, let me touch on views about the American dream. It has different meanings, and those have changed over time. The belief that if you work hard, you can get ahead is widely shared, though it's a little more fragile than it has been in the past. Most people still believe that they have or will be able to reach their version of the American dream. But a big change that we see appears below those national level indicators. Whites no longer believe that their children will do better than they have done. African Americans and Hispanics are very confident on this score. This is one of the most significant changes that I've seen in public opinion data, and I hope that Glenn and Henry might address its origins. Thank you very much.